From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, East Coast choreographer Matthew Neenan and his new work created for Sacramento Ballet. Also, artist Rafael Delgado. He has an unconventional background, and his recent abstract works can be seen in a new show in an Oak Park art gallery. And this week's Sound Advice checks out opera with Capital Public Radio's Sean Bianco. But first, is it time to reconsider some of the most complex and controversial characters in the Bible, like Judas Iscariot and Mary Magdalene? A California theologian who contributed to a recent and highly acclaimed new translation of the New Testament thinks so. He's Marvin Meyer, professor and chair of religious studies at Chapman University. He's in town today. This evening at UC Davis, Dr. Meyer will give a talk titled The Gospels of Judas, Mary and Thomas, The Rehabilitation of Marginalized Disciples in Early Christian Literature. He's in our studio. Marvin Meyer, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's good to be here.
Well, I mentioned Judas and Mary in my introduction, but there's also Thomas is one of the subjects of your talk. Remind us of who Thomas is.
Well, we know Thomas perhaps better as Doubting Thomas, because he, in the New Testament, has lots of doubts and comes to belief with great difficulty. What is interesting is that one of these new texts that has been found in the sands of Egypt is the Gospel of Thomas. And let me assure you that in the Gospel of Thomas, Thomas has no doubts, but he is, in fact, somebody who is thought to have real insight into who Jesus is.
Well, why was his gospel not in the Bible, and why was he in the Bible if we didn't have his gospel?
Well, you know, when it came to deciding on the very fact of a New Testament or what text should be included in a New Testament, there really was a battle that went on. There were struggles and debates and arguments about what to include and what not to include. And frankly, emerging Orthodox thought led the way in deciding which texts to include and which to exclude. And the Gospel of Thomas is a more mystical text and does not really fit in with some of the theological points of the emerging Orthodox Church, so it was not included.
Well, what were the doubts that he is famous, that he famously and apparently wrongly held?
Well, in the Gospel of John, it is said that Thomas maintained that he could not believe unless he would be able to touch Jesus and touch the wounds and so forth. And then he reluctantly but belatedly finally came to believe. That is very different from the Gospel of Thomas.
I see. So, and the Gospel of Thomas was written by Thomas?
No, the Gospel of Thomas probably was not written by Thomas any more than the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are written by those people. These are names that really have been added later on.
So why should we trust the Gospel of Thomas more than the story of Thomas in the New Testament if neither were written by him?
Right. I wouldn't say that we should trust any of them. We should be critical thinkers about all these texts. But frankly, all these texts deserve to be put on kind of a level playing field, you know, and examined in the same kind of way. They're all historically reliable. And as early Christian literature, they can all contribute to the diversity of early Christianity and an appreciation of that diversity.
My guest is Marvin Meyer of Chapman University. He's talking at UC Davis this evening about the Gospels of Judas, Mary, and Thomas. Well, let's turn to Mary now. Why does she need rehabilitation?
Well, In the New Testament, Mary Magdalene plays a rather prominent role. And as the New Testament was interpreted, it was increasingly thought that Mary Magdalene was a whore, wrongly thought, as a matter of fact. It was bad exegesis, but it was thought that she was a whore, but a repentant whore. And a whole wealth of artwork and reflection has gone into that. It's a very moving story, but a repentant whore is not the kind of person that makes for a good apostle or disciple. Now we know that, in fact, Mary was not actually in the text themselves thought of in that way. It was just a bad interpretation. But in the Gospel of Mary, Mary plays a much more prominent role than even in the New Testament Gospels, so that we have a figure that really is one of the leading disciples. She's in the circle of disciples, and in fact, she is closer to Jesus than any of the other disciples, and she's the one who interprets Jesus and so on in the Gospel of Mary.
You said that the notion that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute was the result of a bad translation, but given the hard time that women have had in many religions over a long period of time, do you think that was just a mistake, that translation, or was that a reinterpretation of a woman for the convenience of certain persons' perspectives?
You know, it's hard to get into the motivation of various people, but it was Gregory the Great who came up with this interpretation, as a matter of fact. And he put two chapters in the Gospel of Luke together and drew this wrong conclusion. And what his motivation was, who knows? But certainly it is the case that often women have been vilified in various ways in the literature. And one can imagine that there might have been some reasons for this to be a satisfying interpretation.
We're talking about the New Testament with theologian Marvin Meyer of Chapman University. Let's turn now to Judas, who you will also be talking about at UC Davis tonight and who you've also written about.
Right.
Judas Iscariot, he's probably the most famous among the general public of these three New Testament characters. He's generally considered to be the betrayer of Jesus. Should we reconsider that story?
Well, when the Gospel of Judas came to light, it really kind of took the world by storm, probably in large part just because of the title, the Gospel of Judas, meaning Judas Iscariot. How can you pronounce those words in the same breath, Gospel and Judas Iscariot? And there is a different kind of picture of Judas that emerges in the Gospel of Judas. He is very close to Jesus. Jesus reveals mysteries to him, explains the nature of the universe, explains how one can draw close to God and so on. And this is done with Judas Iscariot. So there is rather a different kind of approach. And what this has provided is the occasion for us to take a look at the Bible and other texts and reimagine who the figure of Judas was. And I think this does, in fact, become a time for us to look at those texts again in a fresh way. And it may be, in fact, time for some kind of rehabilitation of the figure of Judas. It looks as if, historically speaking, a good case can be made that Judas Iscariot was not the betrayer of Jesus, but this is a kind of a literary device. It's a story, a famous kind of a story of brother against brother, friend against friend, and so forth that we can find in a lot of literature. And if that's the case, perhaps it's time to give Judas his due as somebody who, in fact, was close to Jesus.
Well, what does that mean then for our understanding of the New Testament today if Judas Iscariot was perhaps not the betrayer of Jesus? And even if he was, he at least had a more complex relationship with him than the stereotype that Mary was not a prostitute and Thomas didn't doubt.
Well, I think that one of the things this does is it gives us a chance to take a fresh look at these kinds of texts and to see that there are various kinds of motivations that are written into the text. And certain people are vilified in the text as characters. And if we take a fresh look at this, it may undo some of the kinds of biases that we have had. You know, for instance, with a figure like Mary Magdalene, if we take a fresh look at her, it may give us a better kind of appreciation for the role of women in the church and the possibilities for expanding that kind of role and accepting women fully in church and society. With a figure like Judas, it may give us a chance to rethink the role of Judas in the history of the church and in culture, because Judas really has become kind of the poster boy for anti-Semitism. And in much of Christian art, Judas often looks as if he's just a bad Jewish person and has been used in that way. What if this becomes an occasion for us to address this particular aspect of anti-Semitism? It may give us a chance to look afresh at this and address this ongoing problem in society.
We've been talking about Gospels. What does the word gospel mean originally, and where does it come from?
It comes from Greek. Well, it actually comes from Old or Middle English, good spell, good news. But that, in turn, is a translation of a Greek word, evangelion, which means good announcement or good news. And so a gospel is supposed to be good news. It's supposed to be a good announcement.
Which is why it would seem a contradiction for many people that there would be a gospel of Judas, because there couldn't be good news about Judas.
Absolutely. And in fact, just expand that a little bit. The idea that there is good news that is associated with Thomas, often thought to be doubting Thomas, with Mary, sometimes thought to be a secondary kind of person who was a repentant prostitute, and then the betrayer of Jesus. All of that gives us a chance to rethink these characters, rethink the role of these characters, and draw some rather fresh conclusions.
In your translation of the Gospels of Judas, Mary, and Thomas, you actually use older versions of the names, don't you? Thomas, isn't it? Did I... Did I read that correctly?
Right. Well, I actually have had occasion to do several translations for different kinds of audiences. And the translation you are referring to is an effort to get back to the Semitic names. That in itself is rather interesting. What if we use these Semitic names as opposed to Greek or Latin versions of the names to give a kind of a sense of who these people were? They were, after all Jewish people, you know. And so what if we call Jesus Yeshua? That's what his mama called him. What if we call Judas, Judah, or Yehuda, which was his name, as a matter of fact, and Miriam, and so forth, for Mary. It gives us, once again, I think, a new way of looking and appreciating the cultural context of these people, where they lived and when they lived.
Is all of this controversial in some Christian circles?
It is somewhat controversial, I suppose. I guess I would have to say that my experience has been that most people are very appreciative of this, and they see that there is incredible new light that is shed on the story of Christian beginnings, of the historical Jesus, and so forth, by these texts. And thank goodness that Egypt has produced all these texts, has divulged all these texts out of its dry sand, because it really has given us a new appreciation for just the diverse approaches of early Christianity. There are some people who do find this to be somewhat of a threat because of the fact that these are new approaches and new questions. I think very exciting questions, but new questions that come up. But these questions can be used, I think, to advance thought and really to give us a more accurate picture of how things were at the beginning of the Christian church.
Any reason to think that there are other documents still to be found in the Middle East that could shake up the Bible in other ways? New Gospels to be found?
You know, Jeffrey, I remain confident that probably there are more documents. In fact, I can tell you now, I'm not really at liberty to say much about it, but there are, in fact, texts that are being translated that have been found. Probably not quite as spectacular as these Gospels, but Egypt is a big country, and there are lots of possibilities that more texts have been preserved there. So we wait in hope for more texts to appear.
And you can't talk about those because it's not certain yet what they are, or because there's some confidentiality
because
agreement.
They're in the process of being produced by some Europeans and so forth, and they will make the announcement in due time. So keep on listening to the radio and reading your newspaper.
But are these Gospels?
They're not Gospels, but they are documents that deal with the story of the early church.
I see. And finally, Marvin Meyer, I note that in addition to teaching about the New Testament and early Christianity, you also teach ancient Greek language and, upon occasion, Coptic Egyptian. What are the occasions for teaching Coptic Egyptian?
Well, I have made a kind of a pact with my students. When there is a student of goodwill and of good ability and conviction who comes up to me with a look of sincerity in the eye and says, "Dr. Meyer, would you teach me Coptic?" I will rarely turn that person down. And in fact, this year I've had one student who has taken Coptic because, you see, you can't learn Coptic in many places. There aren't many schools around where Coptic is taught. And yet it's a rich language that is the language of so many of these texts. And the experience has always been a good one to introduce a student to that language and then allow that student to be a part of the conversation in the future.
But there are no native speakers of Coptic Egyptian nowadays. Do you know how it was spoken, what it would have sounded like?
Well, we have an idea, as a matter of fact, of what it sounded like, but there really are questions. You're right about that. There are people in the Coptic Orthodox Church who understand that this is their liturgical language, and so it is kind of coming back, as a matter of fact. There is a comeback for Coptic.
Well, I'm
perhaps
glad to
soon
hear it.
We're all going to be learning Coptic, one hopes.
Yes, one hopes indeed. Dr. Marvin Meyer, he's professor and chair of religious studies at Chapman University. His expertise includes the New Testament and early Christianity. Tonight at UC Davis, starting at 5:30, he'll be talking about the Gospels of Judas, Mary, and Thomas. It happens at the Bueller Alumni and Visitor Center at UC Davis. Marvin Meyer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, East Coast choreographer Matthew Neenan and his new work created for Sacramento Ballet. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can tell us what you think about our show. Email us, insight@capradio.org. There are other options at our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Later today on Talk of the Nation, should government do more monitoring of assisted living facilities? Also, an academic who specializes in special operations says the killing of Osama bin Laden may set the stage for a new terror campaign from Al-Qaeda by helping the terrorist group become more decentralized and therefore nimble. And the search in Africa for the origins of human life. It's coming up in Talk of the Nation starting at 11, right after Insight. A young but already acclaimed choreographer is in town. He's Matthew Neenan. Until 4 years ago, he was a principal dancer with the Philadelphia Ballet. Now he's creating a successful career as a choreographer, and his works have already been performed by notable companies. This weekend, Sacramento Ballet will perform a new work by Neenan. He joins us. Matt Neenan, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us how this came about. You live on the East Coast. How did you come to create a new piece that's going to be premiered by Sacramento Ballet?
Well, this is actually the second work I've done for Sacramento Ballet. The first piece I did for the company was back in, I think, the fall of 2009 for their Capital Choreography Competition. And the piece went over very well. And
you were the winner, if I'm not
mistaken.
I was
the winner, yeah, fortunately. And they invited me back to create a new work for this program.
Yes, and the work is called Random Bond. What does that mean?
Well, I kind of came up with that because the piece is for, it has three women and five gentlemen, and they all have a very unique, what's great about the company is they all have their very, you know, their own unique voice, yet they are a tight community. So this piece deals with, you know, they start together and there's a definite bond between them all. But then they kind of break out and they discover themselves.
Were there any conditions, requirements, suggestions attached to this commission?
Not really. I think Ron Cunningham, he had asked me to kind of do something that might be good as a closer or something that's a little more fun-spirited for the program. So
yours is the final piece on the show?
It is the final piece, yes.
Is that more pressure or is that more fun?
It depends on how you look at it. It can be either way. Usually when I have a premiere, you know, when I do work for Pennsylvania Ballet, usually the world premiere is on, you know, in the middle of the program. But I've had directors. I actually did a piece for Colorado Ballet last summer, and they asked for a closing piece. It's something they might want for their repertoire. So,
what does that mean if a company asks for a closing piece?
It doesn't necessarily have to be fun and campy and a crowd pleaser. It's just got to be something that kind of has a nice period for the end of the evening. So it doesn't necessarily mean you have to do something that ends with a big bang. It can have a soft ending, but you know, maybe it's the piece of the evening that really means something.
Well, who wouldn't want that? I mean, does a company ever see, don't give me a closer. I want something that's
exactly
not as unique and compelling as that.
Exactly.
My guest is Matthew Neenan. He's a ballet choreographer. Random Bond, a new work by him, is being premiered by Sacramento Ballet this weekend. It opens as part of the Sacramento Ballet's Modern Masters show on Friday night at the St. Francis Arts Complex and continues at several venues over the next week or so. You danced with the Pennsylvania Ballet for many years until 2007. Did you just get to the point where your body said, I can't be a dancer anymore?
It wasn't so much my body. It was more my mental.
Really?
It was at that point, I started choreographing fairly young when I was in the company, when I was 23 years old. So my dance career and my choreographic career were kind of paralleled. Which was wonderful, but after a certain point, then I co-direct and founded a company called Ballet X in Philadelphia, and that started taking up a lot of my time as well. And I started getting commissions from other companies to choreograph. So at that point, something had to go. You know, and in my 20s, it was great wearing all these different hats and being really busy, and I kind of got off on that, you know, that constant, you know, every day, like I'm doing this, and then in this hour I'm dancing, and then in this hour I have to choreograph, and then in the next hour I have a board meeting, and you know, but after a while that I started you know, I felt like I was spreading myself too thin, and I felt, you know, the dance, it was time to give up the dancing. And that was, you know, I was still in my early 30s, and, you know, at that point it was, you know, there's a new generation coming up, and you kind of like had to hand it over to them and said, well, it's their turn now, and I, it's yeah. time for me to move on. I'm still in the field, so I never felt like I really quit dancing. You know, I'm just not performing anymore.
Must be a big jump, though, to go from a paycheck with a prominent ballet company to being a self-employed choreographer.
Absolutely. But my older sister, God love her, she made sure when I was getting commissions from other companies, you know, she was like, you're putting that money away, right? You're putting that money away. You're putting, you know, she's like, yes, you can live off your dancer check, but all your extra commissions, she's like, that's the time to invest. So I did that, and I set myself up for that.
If you want to see Matthew Neenan working with Sacramento Ballet Dancers, there's a great video on our Facebook page, and it'll no doubt be on our webpage too. It was made by Andrew Nixon, who's our new multimedia producer here at Capital Public Radio. I think you'll enjoy it. Matt, do you still have aches and pains from your days as a dancer? Because when I watch a ballet dancer, it seems like it takes the most extraordinary makes the most extraordinary physical demands on the person.
Definitely. I still feel it from time to time. Luckily, my body's pretty pliable, so I didn't have a lot of injuries that most dancers have, fortunately. Partly, I think, because I was choreographing during my dance career, I wasn't dancing full out every day and really pounding my body. So I felt like I was pretty good to my body because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't constantly like banging it around and throwing myself around. I had a constant shoulder injury, so that took me out of certain ballets that had certain lifts because I'm very hyperextended in my shoulders and in my legs. So there were just certain things I couldn't do or that I just would say, I can't do this because my shoulder's going to pop out of the socket, which it would actually all the time. That was the one injury that was always bothering me. And it hasn't happened since I stopped dancing. Yeah. So that's a good thing.
I guess so.
But I've had no surgeries or, you know, I've been pretty lucky.
Now, when you create a new piece like Random Bond for Sacramento Ballet, how do you come up with it?
Well,
and how do you record what you come up with?
Good question. Well, luckily for recording, we have video now, so I'll even videotape the rehearsals. You know, I originally choreographed this last fall, so that was videotaped, and then the dancers revisit it in the spring, you know, look at the video so they can get it back in their body. But
you mean you choreographed it with the dancers of Sacramento Ballet?
Yes.
I see.
Yes. And when I came back, you know, then the piece was rehearsed. Corrine Binda, the co-artistic director, who also serves as their ballet mistress, she, you know, then kind of went over the steps with the dancers that we did in the fall. And then I came back and I kind of made some changes to the piece and tweaked it and coached it. And now it's ready for the stage.
When you came here last fall to work on the choreography, how much of the choreography was already in your mind and how much of it was created with the dancers on the floor?
It's pretty much created with the dancers from the start. When I first started choreographing in my novice years, I felt like I had to know all the steps before I came into the studio and all the counts to the music. And, you know, I would work at the studio until 10 or 11 at night. You know, this was when I was younger, I guess I could do that. And next day I would come in and be like, no, it's this. And then you do this step on count one and then it goes to count eight. And I felt like that, it hindered the process. You know, it wasn't for them. And what you do on yourself never looks like what you do on the actual dancer who's going to perform it. So I usually come in completely naked. I have an idea in my head if I know, as long as I know the music well. But even sometimes I don't even know what music I'm going to use. And you just come up and start working on, you know, vocabulary. And that's, to me, is when the most beautiful work turns up.
Well, how do the dancers react to that? Because I could imagine some dancers saying, hey, you're the choreographer. Tell us what to do.
Yes, but I think dancers are changing now. I think they really want to be part of the collaborative process so that they really feel like they're creating the work with you and that they, a part of their soul, is part of the work.
Does this mean then that if you'd been commissioned last fall by a different ballet company and you'd worked on it the same way, that the final result might have been a bit different because you'd been working with different dancers?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because you have to use their gifts. You know, you have to, you know, what I try to the first day of rehearsal when I don't know the dancers, these dancers I already knew. So I had an idea of what they could do, what their weaknesses were, what their strengths are. But when I'm working with a new group of dancers that first day, I really try to tune in to like, oh, this dancer can jump higher. This dancer can do some multiple turns. You know, you got to fit that within the work because you need to let the dancer feel special.
And at this point, as the show is about to premiere tomorrow night, but you're in town, how actively involved are you in the rehearsals? Are you just watching or are you still choreographing?
Oh, yeah. And you still make little changes. I mean, and especially once you're in the theater, your whole perspective changes because now you have this distance from them. So you see new things. And so, you know, I'll make little notes and be like, oh, I got to, you know, it might even be the most simplest thing, like the way the head's positioned. But from the audience perspective, that makes all the difference.
Matthew Neenan, he's a choreographer, and a new work by him called Random Bond will be premiered by Sacramento Ballet this weekend. You can see it along with other pieces in a show called Modern Masters. It opens Friday and runs through Sunday at the St. Francis Arts Complex in Sacramento. Then it continues next weekend, the weekend after rather, May 19th at the Studio Theater at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis, which is, I believe, sold out, and wraps up May 21st at Three Stages at Folsom Lake College. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll talk with self-taught abstract artist Rafael Delgado. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's no Insight tomorrow. Instead, at this time, you'll hear novelist Terry McMillan, who was speaking recently in Sacramento for California Lectures. McMillan's latest book, Getting to Happy, revisits characters from her famous earlier work, Waiting to Exhale. Sacramento's Artist of the Year in 2010 has a new show. He's Rafael Delgado, a largely self-taught abstract artist. He's best known as a painter, but is expanding into other styles like sculpture. Delgado's show in Sacramento includes new work, and it's at a fine art gallery in the city's Oak Park neighborhood. He has a reception tonight. There's also a reception at the weekend during Second Saturday. Right now, he's in our studio. Rafael Delgado, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Why did you choose to have your show at Evolve the Gallery, which is a gallery in Oak Park? The main cluster of galleries is in Midtown, mm-hmm. of course.
Well, I wanted to get outside of the grid and really show with a gallery that specializes in contemporary, evocative work. And my new work, it's very robust and very energetic, and I just thought it was a great space to show this type of work.
What do you mean by robust and energetic? Are these paintings?
Yeah, these are paintings. The new show is called Breakthrough. So each work, it's very explosive, and there's a radiating energy that is inherent in each painting. So I kind of I want to show that part of it.
How do you get yourself up for making works like that? Do you need to feel robust and energetic yourself?
Yeah, inside I feel that way, but I really want to. I was a recluse for the last 5 months working on this new show, so it's all very internal thoughts and very complex. So I really wanted to just show the world what I have to offer.
You said you were a recluse for what, like 5 months?
About working? 5 months, yeah.
Meaning but, what? I mean, how many hours a day, how many days a week were you working on this?
Some days I would work 16, 17 hours. I mean, like all-nighters working on this. My roommate, he's a saint because he just puts up with my crazy antics.
And you work at a studio, not at your home.
You've got a place I work you go both to. Now. Yeah. My studio is at Panama Pottery, so it's a tiny little cake slice of a studio. So that filled up rather quickly, and then I invaded my home studio.
Where's Panama Pottery?
Panama Pottery, it's across the street, basically, from Sac City College on 24th Street.
And why did you go there? Because you used to have a studio in a more central place.
Yeah, I was at a kind of the epicenter of the Midtown grid for 4 years, where I met hundreds and hundreds of people. And then after winning the award, I felt that, you know, I just wanted to kind of go underground and show something new, get off the map for a while.
Why, were you feeling pressures
absolutely.
Of one kind or another?
Absolutely. What? Just pressures to perform, pressures to do both, be a salesman and a retailer and then a crazy artist as well.
But isn't that inevitably part of the job?
Yeah, but at the end of the day, a gallery is going to be representing you. You know, it's rare that you find an artist who also does all the marketing, PR, and gallery, wine, all that stuff.
Sure. Well, I can understand why one might not want to get into that if you're an artist. But on the other hand, doesn't that ultimately give you more control over your future and how you're presented to the world?
Yeah, it does. But I'm very close with the owners of Evolve, and they really kind of let me show what I wanted to show. I mean, some of the work they didn't see until I dropped it off, and they loved it. So I have a supportive gallery. My sister Veronica does all my PR, so she's very supportive and very active in the arts community.
And she's pretty good at the PR business.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's very interwoven in many different facets.
Yeah. My guest is Rafael Delgado. He's an artist. There's a show of his new work in Sacramento at Evolve the Gallery. It's a fine art gallery in the Oak Park neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And there's a reception tonight.
Tonight, yeah, it's 6 to 9. Please join.
And then a more festive type of reception, I guess, for Second Saturday.
Second Saturday, yeah.
Yeah, which starts at 5 p.m. on Saturday. I read that a quote from you, "Everything that I come into contact with visually emerges in my artwork for that day."
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, I work on a daily basis, and I don't take any photographic references. It's purely instinctual and improvisational. So when I step to the canvas, it's not like I'm copying anything. I just say, go. And it's a journey that I take, each painting.
And where did your style come from? It's often described as abstract. Mm-hmm. Does that seem right to you?
Well, this new work is depopulated. There's no figures. It's an illusionary space, and they're abstract. But my style, it's a combination of all the things that I like: cubism, expressionism, abstraction, action art, you know? So it's kind of a hybrid style.
What would you say to someone who looks at abstract art and goes, well, I just don't understand that. I could do that.
Well, my abstract art, it deals with things not of the physical realm. It's closely related to physics. So when you look at my work, think mass, density, velocity, weight, light, space, energy. Now that I put it in that realm, you can kind of put your finger on it.
Yeah, I mean, how could you portray those things in a way that looks like a photograph of a person?
Right, exactly. And most things that we talk about, let's say, I don't know, freedom, liberty, these are all abstract terms. Things like love, how do you express that?
Wow.
Besides abstractly.
Oh, that's an excellent point. you were raised in Orangeville, which is, for people who are not familiar, because it's one of those places that people go, well, I've heard of Orangeville, but
right.
I don't know, I could quite put it on the map. But it's sort of, it's in the eastern part of Sacramento County, and parts of it are kind of semi-rural almost.
It's very rural, rural.
So how were you raised?
It's a well-kept secret.
Yeah, well, yes, indeed. So what kind of family background?
I come from just a very loving, caring family, a wrestling family. We're all wrestlers. And
oh, yeah?
Yeah, except for my sister, of course.
I don't know. I wouldn't want to get in a fight with Veronica.
Right, no, I wouldn't want to. But the dynamic of my family, we're all different. My brother's an accountant. My other brother's a wrestling coach. My sister's in PR. But very supportive in any endeavor.
Were they artists?
No, my father was once a gallery owner. My mother's an artist, but she was busy raising a family, so she couldn't really pursue her art like she should. So, you know what? I think it's my turn, and I'll become the artist. You know?
And what did they think about you becoming an artist? I guess given what they had done themselves.
Well, that's the thing. It's a close, loving family, so sometimes they're my toughest critic. You know, and I know I'm onto something when they like it. You know, they don't like everything I do, but, you know, and that's just part of it. So,
well, what do they like?
They like my new style, and they like things that are good. You know, it's hit or miss, right?
Yeah. Now, you said that people have enjoyed doing wrestling in your family, and you got this sort of athletic-looking sweatshirt on with a hood, and it says 1794 on it. What does that refer to?
Oh, I don't know.
You don't know.
It's just something I got at the Goodwill.
Yeah. You and your sister have a charity. Tell us about that.
The Crayons to Canvas Art Supply Drive is held every December. This will be our fourth year, and it's to benefit the Stanford Home for Children for their art therapy division. And due to a large donation from AT&T, they were able to open their art therapy division at the Stanford Home for Children. So along with all this donation that we're able to procure.
So what are you doing? Are you giving them money or are you giving them art materials?
No, art materials, thousands of pounds of art materials over the course of 4 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, what do you think that does for the kids?
Well, art therapy, it allows the children to retell their story in a creative way to help therapists extract information and help them heal in a positive coping way.
As I mentioned when I introduced you, you were the winner last year of the Artist of the Year named by Sacramento Arts and Business Council. It's a pretty prestigious award, and you beat out two pretty well-known people in the community, performance artist, painter David Garibaldi, and the music director of the Sacramento Philharmonic, Michael Morgan. Must have been a nice feeling to win that.
I was humbled, truly humbled.
Yeah. What are your plans? It seems like you're a restless guy artistically. What do you see yourself doing in the future?
My friend, this is a lifelong pursuit. You know that. I try to forget about it and think about the future. And I know that the eyes are on me. So I've been up literally night and day working at that award and just making my new work to earn that title.
Well, are you working on your next show?
I'm working on my next show.
Something is it something different looking?
It's different. Stay tuned.
So you're not going to tell us?
I don't know what I will be painting, but I will be. And it'll be purely instinctual, purely improvisational, and, you know.
And how do you move into a new style of painting? Is that because you go, you know what, I've just done a show, put together work for a show. I need to do something different. Or is it just sort of a natural process?
I think there's some trademark qualities in my work. I use a lot of robust shapes and clearly delineated lines and things like that. But I just think, you know, if it comes from me and I pay attention and I do my best, you know, quality is my style.
I like your slogan. If it is
right
one.
Right on, right on.
Rafael Delgado, artist. There's a show of his new work in Sacramento. There's a reception tonight and a second Saturday reception on Saturday evening. His show is called Breakthrough. It's at Evolve the Gallery, a fine art gallery in Sacramento's Oak Park neighborhood, and the exhibit runs through May 28th. Rafael, thanks so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, operatic sound advice with Sean Bianco. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later today on Capital Public Radio News, home foreclosures in California fell 7% last month, but the reason is temporary problems with the foreclosure process, and once that's resolved, foreclosures could well pick up again. Speaking of which, the Sacramento area housing market last month saw a big month-over-month increase in bank repossessions. Those stories and more during All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio News. Time now for Insight's weekly music feature, Sound Advice. This week, we're joined by opera expert Sean Bianco, host of Capital Public Radio's Friday Night at the Opera. Sean, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you for having me again.
And what are we going to start with today?
Well, I'm going to be introducing something that I think is very important for people who are interested in opera or even great music in general to take a listen to. The Nimbus Record Company, which was founded in 1972, the founders of that company basically created surround sound, as we now know it, in living room audio theaters and whatnot. Well, a division of Nimbus has dedicated itself to capturing the 78 shellac recordings of 1900 and forward. And in that Prima Voce series, you can hear some of the greatest singers who did not make it into the modern recording world. And I brought a few examples with us today. Now, I'm always saying on my opera show or people are asking me, what constitutes great singing? What does that mean? What does great singing mean? And when is it singing and when is it just yelling? And I hear a lot of singers today who tend to yell a lot and not sing. Mm. Well, these singers that I have with us today are people that were the singers. They were often referred to as the golden age of singing. And there's three components to great singing, I think. Purity of tone, accuracy of pitch, and clarity of text. These singers of this era and that Nimbus captured so amazingly, which I'll tell a little bit more about after the first selection, exemplify that wonderful quality in those qualities. And I think people will be able to hear how wonderful these singers were.
Well, who's the first singer?
The first singer I have was a wonderful Italian baritone by the name of Giuseppe Di Luca, who was born 1876 and died in 1950. He was one of the greatest exponents of what they called bel canto singing, or beautiful singing, which comprised of many different components, but he was one of the great exponents of bel canto singing. And here's a selection from the opera Rigoletto by Verdi, and you'll be hearing him sing with another great singer of that time, Amelita Gallicurci, a great soprano of his era. This is an excerpt from Verdi's Rigoletto.
I'm no expert, but it sounds different from the way I would imagine that being sung today.
Yes. Back then, the emphasis, again, was on purity of tone, accuracy of pitch, where the voice lied right in the center of the pitch. And the notes on the page that were written by the composer were the most important thing to that singer. And the audiences then expected it. Now what we have is we have several generations later of singers who had resorted to, yelling or not really even singing anymore, where the vibrato of their voice has become so wide you can't hear the pitch anymore. And that also distorts the tone and the text. So these guys knew they were the real deal. They knew what audiences expected, and I think the expectation from audiences has changed over the years.
So these recordings have been, I guess, remastered from 78. So if you didn't have a very old-style record player, you wouldn't have been able to hear these.
Exactly, and that's why the Nimbus Records have done such a service to opera fans all over the world.
Well, we've got a couple more singers to hear.
Before we hear the second one, I want to explain quickly how they recorded these.
Okay.
Before now, as in the case of RCA, they transferred these shellac recordings, these 78s, directly from the disc into a board and remastered the recordings digitally and then put them on CDs. Nimbus did it in a different way. They built, in a castle in England, a wooden recital concert hall. Put on the stage of the concert hall, an old phonograph player built a 7-foot wooden horn, 7 feet in diameter, set it next to the phonograph player, played the old 78, and hung microphones out in the hall.
Oh, my goodness.
And captured the sound as if an audience would be hearing it.
Oh.
So you're hearing this sound removed as an audience member, not hearing it directly being transferred through wires and microphones and all that stuff.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's why it has such a clear, very precise sound. This next singer, who was known who died 1960, prematurely, unfortunately. He was 49 years old. Swedish tenor Jussi Björling. Now, he was very popular at the Met and very popular during broadcasts at the Met and made it well into the modern recording era. But the very first part of his career in Sweden was captured in the late 30s by RCA Victor over in Europe. And here is the Nimbus transfer of one of his early recordings, an excerpt from La Belle Helena by Offenbach. This is the voice of Swedish tenor Jussi Björling, and the brilliance of the voice is unbelievable. Just
beautiful.
Unbelievable. He was in his late 20s when they recorded that over in Sweden. Hearing that voice that young in his career for me was just a treat. Again, you know, his voice was heard later, of course, in electrified microphone recordings into the 40s and 50s. But hearing his voice transferred in this way, in this acoustic ambient environment, and capturing it with just two-point miking system, in a live recital hall instead of directly from the shellac discs, I think gives a much warmer and much more enjoyable ambient experience for the audience. And that's why people should really look into getting these Nimbus recordings.
And you got one more with you?
I do. One of my favorite singers, Enrico Caruso, who was the first big opera star and the first big recording star with RCA. He was a big American, he was a huge fan. He had a huge fan base in the U.S., and especially New York. And around the First World War, he recorded this next piece in English, Cohan's Over There. You have to hear this. Jimmy, get your gun. Back hit on the run. Yeah, I'm calling you and me, every son of liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, go today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to fight, to be proud thereby in life.
Here we go. Oh, that is wonderful.
Yep.
It sounds almost like an operetta, the way he's singing it.
Yeah, it was a great... his interpretation of that song, Over There, was huge. It sold millions of copies. And in 1918, you can imagine what that meant. He was the first recording artist for RCA to sell a million copies of a single song on a single record.
So these recordings from the Nimbus label just out recently?
They began recording these in 1990.
Oh.
And they're still recording them. They now have a vast, enormous library.
Beautiful.
Of these great old singers. And the Prima Voce series, I'm slowly getting more and more of them over the years. But this is the great way to really hear the golden age singers of yesteryear.
Sean Bianco, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You can hear Sean every Friday night. Friday night at the Opera on Capital Public Radio's Classical Station. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver and Liz Cazares. The technical director, Mark Jones. The senior producer, Jen Picard.